find the defendants incredibly guilty.
Find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Same.
Break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 253, and it's Valentine's Day edition. Andrew, will you be my Valentine?
I was hoping you'd ask that, Thomas. All right. I cannot imagine anyone with whom I would more want to spend today than my life partner, my Opening Arguments partner, Thomas Smith. How are you doing? You and Lydia. We should, if we have new listeners, we should be clear. Like we're both married. We both have Valentine's Day plans.
We're both married
plans,
to each other. We both, yeah. I don't have any Valentine's Day plans other than being sick and spending it with my real Valentine, Andrew Torres. That's right, everybody. I said it. I think Lydia listens, so she'll hear this and laugh. So sorry for the voice. This is a particularly bad one. That's the life of a dad is getting sick every 5 seconds, but we can't be stopped. We've got too much stuff to talk about. Probably an anger inducing episode. I suppose we can do content warning, because the world sucks. This particular story made me pretty upset, and, I imagine it might make you upset too. So that's always fun, but we got to hear about it. We got to learn what's going on, and we got to have Andrew break it down for us. But first we get a Andrew Was Wrong segment, that I'm looking forward to. And then we take a little trip up Yodel Mountain. It seems to me, do you feel like, Andrew, that sometimes we're caught in a Groundhog Day of Yodel Mountains? Like I see Manafort lied, and then I'm like, didn't we do this? I've done this, right? We go to Gobbler's Knob. It's Groundhog Day. Dun, 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 and Manafort lies, and then nothing happens.
Manafort lying is not exactly the most original headline that I can put on our whiteboard. Yeah. But no, this is an important judicial determination that Manafort lied.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get there.
I just picture you saying Manafort lying, and I say, it's still only once a year, isn't it?
It's going to be cold, it's going to be gray, and it's going to last you the rest
of your life. Yes, it is. Yodel Mountain. There it is. Okay, so that's our episode. And also, a very exciting show announcement first. Andrew went on Mueller, She Wrote last week, or was it the week before?
Yeah, it is last week. So it's actually this current episode. It released on Sunday, and you can still hear me on Mueller, She Wrote. It's a fantastic episode, if I do say so myself.
It absolutely is. And we are going to have AG of Mueller, She Wrote on next episode. Can't wait.
Woo!
Really excited about that. It is a match made in heaven. It's chocolate and peanut butter or something. I don't know. Reese's peanut butter cups. I'm sick. Give me a break. All right. I'm very excited about it.
As I said, I think I said this on social media, so I'll repeat it here. The Mueller, She Wrote show is basically like a 1 to 2 hour trip up Yodel Mountain with swearing. Mm. So, you know, it's...
Why didn't we think of that?
Yeah, I know. Seriously.
No, we got to do deep dives about, res judicata and God knows what. So that's a slightly different show, but a good one either
Thanks.
Way.
Thanks.
No, I was saying it's a different niche. We gotta serve the hardcore law students and the people who want to hear Yodel Mountain. You know, that's where we're going with it.
Good point.
All right.
But no, I'm excited. That's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
I discovered at a very early age that if I talk long enough, I could make anything right or wrong. So either I'm God or truth is relative. And in either case, booyah.
Oh, interesting. It's just the average person has a much harder time saying booyah to moral relativism.
Let's get to Andrew was wrong. So Nikki Fatchett, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but it might be Fatchett probably, says, Andrew stop using the phrase off the reservation? It is quite problematic and offensive to people of Native descent in the U.S. Nikki, I got to tell you, I've tried. I'm going to kind of throw you under the bus, Andrew. There are a few edits where I said, oh, Andrew, you said off the reservation, don't say that. And then he went back. And then I think I've missed it a couple times. And it's one of those things, you know, Andrew, you can say what you want to say about it. But it's just one of those things that I'm sure you know, just grew up learning as not a thing. And then you have to kind of try to do your best to realize that it is. It really would be like if you said to a black person, oh, he's gone off the plantation. It'd be like, that's horrible. You would never say that. So like when you think about what it would mean, it is pretty disturbing. So
no. And as soon as that came through, I wanted us to talk about it, to put it in an Andrew Was Wrong segment. And to say, I totally get it. Right. And yeah, it certainly is. And it's something that I have to unlearn out of my vocabulary. I will tell you, lawyers who are the next half generation up from me, right, who are in their 50s, still sometimes will use the phrase Chinese wall.
Oh, wow.
That was what they used to call, you know, just sort of an ethical wall, right? Like walling off from conflicts. And I remember being a young associate at Covington and Burling and hearing partners say, oh, we'll just set up a Chinese wall. And like looking over at other young associates, you know, who didn't grow up with this in horror, being like, you know, please tell me he's not going to like pull his eyes back or, you know, right.
God,
yeah. I mean, seriously, right. I mean, it's so obvious to me that that's racist. And it is obvious when you point it out how much that phrase is similarly racist. But, you know, it's a question of making sure that you own up to it and that the consciousness of that supersedes sort of the ease and lack of thinking about it. Right?
Yeah.
I just want to emphasize this, right? I want to be called out if I'm saying something that makes me sound like an old out of touch white dude. Right.
Right? Like, yeah. Same please, here. And it's possible I've used it before just because you don't, you know, sometimes don't think of it. And maybe we'll just both say off the rails. We can say off the rails. That's easy because it starts with R. It's the same. We're practically there. Yeah. And then if we don't, then it's Brian's fault because Brian officially, it's now on you. Make sure we don't say anything stupid or offensive.
So no, but Nikki, thank you so much. And we will do our best.
And, you know, I want to turn this into a positive segment here because I actually just finished a book called They're There, and it's by Tommy Orange. And it's about all of these different, it's about, a number of different Native American characters who grew up and live in Oakland. So it's weird because it's so close to me. But it's an incredible book. You know, it's one of those books that the New York Times was buzzing about, and for good reason, because it's really fascinating and it really gives you perspective into how Native Americans are living now. You know, a lot of what we get in our predominantly white view of culture is, you know, the old Western kind of whatever Native American shooting cowboys and Indians crap. And this gives you a picture of what it's like now and how the past has bled into the present. And it's a really good book. So it's called They're There. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I'll go check it out.
All right. With that said, let's move on to a really disturbing story that I hate.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
So tell us about this SCOTUS decision. That you can only, if you're going to be killed by our country, you can only be a Christian. Is that a good summary?
So this is the case of Dunn versus Ray. We are 1 week out. So Dominique Ray was executed by the state of Alabama a week ago today at 10:12 p.m. This is a person who has been executed. You and I are both anti-capital punishment. This is not really, you know, the space for discussing capital punishment. The way in which the story has been portrayed in the press is correct. And if anything, it fails to identify just how horrible this decision is. And this also dovetails with the issue that I was talking about in our bonus episode 251.5, in which I suggested that part of the game, if you're going to have a right-wing activist Supreme Court, is to disguise your activism by ruling on procedural grounds, knowing full well that you're ruling on substantive grounds. And this case exemplifies that to a T.
Oh, great.
I want to clear up a couple of misconceptions. One thing that, as far as I know, no media outlet has pointed out, and then another that is sort of assumed in cases like this. So, point number one, Dominique Ray, who was convicted of murder and is undisputedly a believing Muslim. This is a question about certain religious accommodations that Mr. Ray asked for in connection with his execution. The first one that no court decided to pass on is had to do with a challenge to the method of execution itself. Now, I am not Muslim, so I can't weigh in on this, but Mr. Ray claimed that being executed by lethal injection would be offensive to religious beliefs. Alabama is one of three states that now permits execution by nitrogen asphyxiation, which is what it sounds like. This, in and of itself, and again, I don't want to get too far down a rabbit trail on this. Different groups have sort of gone back and forth about whether nitrogen asphyxiation is more humane, whether it's a good method for executing someone. There have been a lot of stories on the three drug cocktail that is used for lethal injections in the United States and all the problems with that. I don't know how to weigh in on any of that. All I know is that the state, in addition to the two issues that I'm about to talk about, the state also just completely disregarded on procedural grounds Mr. Ray's request to change the method of his execution because they felt as though this was being raised in an untimely manner. Prior to that, however, so Dominique Ray was scheduled to be executed and was in fact executed on February 7th. He petitioned the district court and then appealed up to the 11th Circuit, not a particularly liberal jurisdiction, as you know, seeking two accommodations in connection with his execution. Okay. And this is the other fact that I want to just make 100% clear. This case is not about your typical habeas petitions, right? In it, Dominique Ray does not contest his guilt. He does not say, I don't want the state to execute me. All he says is, I want the state of Alabama to do one of two, to do two things. First, that the state of Alabama defaults to having a Christian chaplain in the room when you are executed, and that person is instructed under Alabama state procedures to either hang back and be unobtrusive if you're not Christian, or to kneel down and pray with you if you want him to pray with you.
This is so freaking weird. We're going to look back on this and this will be medieval times. I mean, this is just insane.
And so the first thing that Mr. Ray wanted was get this chaplain out of the room when I'm being executed. And the second thing he wanted was to have his imam present instead. This seems like a pretty straightforward request. And In fact, the 11th Circuit said, yeah, we think that without ruling on the merits, right, because this was an emergency petition because it was filed on the 28th of January, and Mr. Ray was scheduled to be executed and was, in fact, executed on February 7th. So the 11th Circuit said, look, we do not have time to dig into the merits of this, but we're going to stay his execution long enough for us to adjudicate whether, in fact, Mr. Ray has a right under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act of 2000. That is basically RFRA for, among other things, for federal prisoners. Okay. And the claim is pretty straightforward, right? You allow Christians to have a person of their faith present to minister to them as they are being executed. And it seems completely obvious that if you're going to do that for Christians, you ought to do that for Muslims. That was the request. The 11th Circuit said, and again, 3-0 panel decision, said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Not ruling on the merits, but we're going to stay the execution and until we can rule on the merits. That was then appealed by the state of Alabama to the Supreme Court. And the
I'm sure that'll go well, right? Because the Supreme Court, you know, it's got
to
be.
Yeah, you would you would think, right? If this Supreme Court claims to stand for anything, it claims to stand for religious liberty.
They're going to call balls and strikes on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, of course, the Supreme Court went 5-4 the other way. The 5-justice majority decided that they would vacate the stay of execution entered by the 11th Circuit and allow the execution to go forward before the 11th Circuit or any other court could rule on the merits of the underlying challenge. The reason for doing so is a single paragraph. I'm going to read that paragraph to you in its entirety, and then we're going to talk about how unbelievably disingenuous this paragraph is. So the paragraph says, on November 6th, 2018, the state scheduled Dominique Ray's execution date for February 7, 2019. Because Ray waited until January 28, 2019 to seek relief, we grant the state's application to vacate the stay entered by the 11th Circuit. And then there is a citation, and then the parenthetical for which this case is being cited says, a court may consider the last-minute nature of an application to stay execution in deciding whether to grant equitable relief. So that's it. That is the sole justification. Sorry, you waited too long. I'm going to get to that in a minute. Because I suppose we could steel man the argument and say you don't want to incentivize waiting as long as possible, you know, going all the way up to the dawn, you know, a week before your execution and trying to game the system. And, you know, there needs to be some finality. I guess that's the best that I can make of that argument. However, this is beyond pretextual. This falls directly into the category that I discussed in our bonus episode 251 and a half of the Supreme Court disingenuously rewriting the facts in order to dismiss procedurally a case that they would otherwise have to rule on the merits and hopefully thereby avoid being tagged with an activist label. Because the interest here in we've got to execute this guy tomorrow versus maybe we're violating a person's constitutional rights seem very clearly to those equities, obviously, to trend in the other direction.
Yeah, talk about the ultimate irreparable harm.
Yeah, right. It's much worse than that. And I'm going to read from the 11th Circuit, right? So, by the way, this opinion was in front of the Supreme Court when the 5-justice conservative majority decided that they were going to ignore this and kick out Ray's claims on the basis of Sorry, you slept on your rights. You should have. Look, you knew you were going to be executed in February, back in November of last year. Why'd you wait till January? Well, here's what the 11th Circuit says. Here, however, arguments suggesting unreasonable delay on Ray's part are far less compelling. For starters, a review of the relevant statutory text would not have put Ray or his lawyers on notice that the institution's Christian chaplain would always be present in the execution chamber, or that Ray's imam could never be. The Alabama Code only says that certain persons, quote, may be present at an execution. It does not say that the chaplain will be present. And then quotes the code, which I have looked up, and the 11th Circuit is correct. It lists both the chaplain and, quote, the spiritual advisor of the condemned as among those who may be present, without drawing any distinction between where those two individuals will be situated during the execution. So
we might have thought that it would be fine. Like it sounds like he thought this wouldn't be a problem.
Yes. As the 11th Circuit says, even the most careful review of the statute by Ray or his lawyers would not have revealed that the prison's chaplain will stand in the execution chamber while any other spiritual advisor would need to be in a separate room. As it turns out, on actual facts, as Ray was getting down to 2 weeks before he was about to be executed, he said, okay, well, I want to have my imam present to minister to me as I'm being executed. And on January 23rd, that was when Ray asked and said, okay, so how are you going to arrange this? And that was when the prison said, oh, no, we don't have imam. Are you kidding me? No chance. He was denied his accommodation on January 23rd and filed his complaint on January 28th.
This is unbelievable.
Not only, you want to say unbelievable, right? It gets worse. January 23rd was a Wednesday. The 26th and the 27th were the weekend. The 28th was Monday morning. So in other words, his lawyers in 2 working days turned around and filed a petition in the district court, which then worked its way up to the 11th Circuit and then to the Supreme Court. That initial pleading was filed in 2 days. And let me tell you, if Ray's lawyers, how hard it is to file these sorts of things in 2 days, and if Ray's lawyers had failed to raise something, right, then you would have had all sorts of problems associated with failure to raise, right? So not only did he have to turn it around in 2 days, but his lawyers had to turn around a polished work product that preserved all of Ray's claims with respect to religious accommodation that survived the scrutiny all the way up through to the Supreme Court. To do that in 2 business days and have the Supreme Court say you slept on your rights is
this
monstrous.
Is unbelievable. How do they get away with this? I don't understand it. This is the second thing now where the five justice a-hole brigade is like, oh no, the sky is red, sorry. And then we're like, what? No, the sky is blue. What are you talking? It's in the record. It's in the 11th Circuit said no, sky is blue. We know the sky is blue. And then you're saying nope, sky is red. What? How do they keep doing this? I don't understand it.
I'm going to read a little bit more from the 11th Circuit, right? Because not only is that the inference, but in fact, the state has never argued the position that the Supreme Court invented as grounds for overturning.
How did Robert sign on? I would hope there'd be somebody. You know, you figure you got the 3-4 just totally lost votes, but
I'm going to upload the 11th Circuit's opinion, but this is from page 26 on to 27. The state has provided no evidence that Ray would have learned at any point about these policies or that he could have filed a lawsuit challenging these policies any earlier than he did.
Oh my God.
According to Ray, and it is unrebutted on this record, he first requested and was denied accommodations based on his religion on January 23rd. The state has not provided us with any evidence that Ray knew or should have known that his religious beliefs would not be accommodated prior to January 23rd, or that he had any opportunity to request an accommodation prior to that date. Given the paucity of evidence, it is not altogether surprising that the state has not even clearly argued that Ray knew or should have known sooner that his beliefs would not be accommodated. I could go on, but this is so. The stories that you have read are correct. Alabama has an institutional policy that says we're going to stick a Christian chaplain in the room when you're executed, and that's all you get. I will point out that the state agreed to accommodate half of Mr. Ray's requests voluntarily and excluded the chaplain from the room while Donnie nice Gray was being executed. Did not concede to the presence of the imam. I'm at a loss to
understand
why.
How hard is that? Like, what is? I was going to ask you what is even the why? I mean, it's kind of a little outside of the scope of the lawsuit, I guess. But like, why is this not just done? Is it just so Alabama is a-holes? Is that
so?
I can tell you again. I work for California State Prison in the budget department, and on our line items for salaries and stuff are all kinds of religious, you know, different religious leaders or whatever that come in, chaplains. So that I think in California, it's just the state decided we're jerks. Hey, listeners, you know, I'm always looking for balanced, credible information about the world around me, and I'm sure it's the same for you. That's why you listen to this podcast and you love one Andrew Torres. Well, it's also why I've been a big fan of the Great Courses Plus for years, and this goes back long before this show. I have always loved the Great Courses Plus, and I highly recommend it for you too. With their streaming service, we can learn about virtually anything, deep dives into topics that we want to know more about. And it's the typical stuff, history, politics, human behavior, science, but it's also stuff you might not think about, like travel, cooking, and more. The information is reliable, fact-based, and presented by engaging experts who really are great teachers. As I always say, it's a team of Andrews over there for any topic you might want. And we can watch or listen from anywhere entirely on our own schedule. Got a course recommendation for you. I recommend you check out Privacy, Property, and Free Speech, Law and the Constitution. I think you can tell from the title that it will be right up your alley if you are into this show. It is a fascinating and very relevant course. It delves into how our rights are affected by the rapid changes in technology and social media and offers ideas on how to bring democratic values into the 21st century. I know you're going to love and get so much out of the Great Courses Plus, and right now, our listeners can enjoy a free trial with unlimited access to their entire library. So that's not just any one course. You get to check out whatever you want, browse, look around, learn whatever you want to learn. Start your free trial today. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. That's OA for opening arguments. One last time, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. Go check it out.
The argument that is made, okay, and again, I am doing my best to steel man the state of Alabama here. That's a challenge. The argument that is made is an interest in safety and security that says having somebody in the room when you're being executed, that person needs to follow certain protocols and needs to, you know, be trained in how to be present in the room, such as not to interfere with the execution. I will tell you, the Supreme Court's four sane justice minority, led by Justice Elena Kagan, wrote a dissent which asked the state has offered no evidence to show that its wholesale prohibition on outside spiritual advisors is necessary to achieve any goal in prison security, which I've no doubt that prison security is an important is an interest of that kind, right? A compelling governmental interest. And then Justice Kagan asks, why couldn't Ray's imam receive whatever training and execution protocol that the Christian chaplain received? The state has no answer. Why wouldn't it be sufficient for the imam to pledge under penalty of contempt that he will not interfere with the state's ability to perform the execution? The state doesn't say. That's it. That is the argument. The argument is we have to control who's in the room. Why can't it be the imam? No answer. It's really troubling. It's really, really bad. And the two takeaways that I want you to remember here, again, not remembering pleasant stuff. But the two takeaways are, number one, when this Supreme Court says that it is pro-religious liberty, it means, and we have convincing proof right here, it is pro-religious liberty of the majority religion in this country only. If you are a Muslim, they do not care about your religious liberty. There is no way to square this with any of the court's holdings on Christian religious liberty. And number two, to be on the lookout for the Supreme Court using procedural, pretextual devices to reach the kinds of outcomes that they want to reach. We warned you about it 3 days ago, and this is yet another illustration of that. I wish it weren't terrible, but it is. It's as bad as the mainstream press is making it look, if not worse.
Do we at least get some nice blistering dissent excerpts to read, or no? Is there any good, you know, like RBG? Did I say that right? RBG, notorious RBG. Anything to comfort us?
The dissent is written by Elena Kagan, who is not.
She's a little nicer.
Yeah, she lacks the rhetorical flair of RBG. You should read it. We're going to link this. It's a little bit over a page, and what she says very matter-of-factly, right? So she says, the Alabama prison where Dominique Ray will be executed tonight regularly allows a Christian chaplain to be present in the execution chamber, but Ray is Muslim, and the prison refused his request to have an imam attend him in the last moments of his life. And then concluding, given the gravity of the issue presented here, I think that the decision, the majority's decision, is profoundly wrong. I agree with her on that. I will point out again, the standard that the five justice majority has to use in reversing the decision of the 11th Circuit is the standard of abuse of discretion. So in other words, not only must the Supreme Court be convinced that the 11th Circuit was wrong, but that they were clearly wrong, right? That it was an abuse of discretion. It is one of the highest standards in the law, right? Because, right, discretion means it could be X, it could be Y, and you might say, well, you know, the court went with X. I would have gone with Y, but it was not an abuse of discretion for them to go with Y. And in fact, you see that all the time in appellate litigation, right? To say, no, it could not have been X or Y. It could only have been X. Is the Supreme Court saying, no, the 11th Circuit could only have held as a matter of law that this request was untimely? That is not supported by the record. There is no way to justify this that application of the facts to the law. And again, this is another one of these, you know, our friend Eli Bosnick's, you know, make it black test. If the facts were reversed, if this were Dearborn, Michigan, and a prison had a policy whereby an imam was always present in the execution chamber and Christians were not allowed to have their priest come in and kneel, this wouldn't have gone anywhere, right? It would have been
wall to wall Fox News for the rest of time.
Yes. Absolutely, right? Sharia law in the United States.
Yeah.
There's no way that the prison would not have immediately accommodated. And look, again, it would be one of those rare instances in which we're on the same side as Fox News. We would have said, yeah, no, absolutely, right? Like if you typically have an imam present in the execution chamber, then obviously you should have the Christian chaplain present. Not hard at all to understand the minute you reverse the identities.
What do you think it's like for the sane justices on the Supreme Court? You know, like I know we had the whole, RBG and Scalia were friends. I don't know how that was possible. But like, what do you think it's like for Kagan and for Sotomayor to be like, well, we got a rapist on the court and people who just decide that Muslims don't have the right to be killed with dignity here. Like, how?
I like to think that Antonin Scalia would have come out the other way. You know, I may be romanticizing him now that he's dead.
You've talked about so many of his cases where he specifically protects Christians and no other religion.
No, you're right. I am romanticizing now because now he's dead. So now it's easier for me to, you know, just like opening arguments, good friend Richard Nixon. it's easy to do that. There you go.
Hey, folks, today's show is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. You know, I've mentioned it before. I used to work for the state in a supervisory role. And let me tell you, hiring people is not as fun as you might think if you've never done it before. You can go through those resumes and you usually just see a stack of unqualified people who didn't fill it out right or just sent out a batch resume to a million positions that they're not even really a fit for. It can be a nightmare. But I'll tell you what, going to ZipRecruiter.com/OA will make that process a whole lot easier. And it's important, too, because if you're under pressure, you need to fill a role, the work's piling up, you want to hire someone fast, but if you hire the wrong person, you're stuck with it. It's very hard to unhire somebody. It's a lot easier to hire the right person right away, and that's what ZipRecruiter helps you do. They will send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applicants come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA for opening arguments. One last time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Because, like, I'm sure there's always this desire for, well, I'm sure it's professional and they don't mix their work and their feelings kind of thing. It's like, why not? When something's outrageous, I feel like this idea that, oh, we should all be friends afterwards and whatever, that just preserves the status quo. That's just a tool for people doing outrageous things to continue to do outrageous things. It's like, yeah, I want to be able to do outrageous, fact-ignorant things on the Supreme Court, and then I want everyone to like me afterward. Anyway, sorry.
Rant on, Brother Tom. I mean, I don't know what to say to that other than I think as we move into a time period in which everything is politically polarized to an extent that it was not in the past, that I it wouldn't surprise me to see those norms break down. And let me do a 30-second sidebar on that, right? You can determine statistically in the past that when the Supreme Court was profoundly liberal during the Warren Court in the early 70s, right? No question, Supreme Court was liberal. The Supreme Court authored its decisions at the time that meet the strongest criteria for left-wing judicial activism, right? That is, cases that break from prior precedent and do so on what appear to be outcome-driven grounds, right? If we're gonna be 100% fair in the criticism that is raised on the right, you do not see the same level of 5-4 decisions come about. We know where they are because of on a narrow partisan basis how the justices lined up. And the clearest example for that, as we have pointed out, is Roe v. Wade was a 7-2 opinion, right? Roe v. Wade was among the justices not particularly controversial at the time. It certainly was not a close opinion. And there are the only cases that I can think of, and we've done a past deep dive into both of these, that really fit the model of contemporary jurisprudence were the Supreme Court's capital punishment cases, right? The Furman v. Georgia and Gregg v. Georgia, in which the Supreme Court, you know, backtracked very quickly after determining in a plurality opinion that capital punishment violated the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. And I think the reason for that has to do with the deeply held personal convictions of the justices, including William Brennan, as I've said, personal hero of mine, who I think very candidly admitted that, you know, it was the intersection of their deeply held personal convictions that sort of drove their jurisprudence in those cases. So those cases were controversial and narrow and partisan, and the Supreme Court reversed itself. That is the exception that proves the rule from the 1970s. I don't know what it was like in 1817 when the judiciary was dominated by Federalists and Federalists as a party were dead at the national level. Right? I can imagine there was a lot of craziness going on in the courts at that time. I don't really have access to that, and it's super hard to read early 19th century court opinions, so I haven't read a whole lot of them, not since law school anyway. But I can tell you, you know, we try and flag the both sides do it too. This is not a both sides do it too to the same degree. When the Supreme Court tilted left, it did not do so in as aggressive and as partisan a way as this Supreme Court does right now. This Supreme Court to the right, like the Rehnquist Court, was not, you know, had unpredictable decisions and had a lot of 9-0 and 8-1 and 7-2 decisions, right? This is the continuation of a process that is, you know, destroying our political system. So I realized that was a longer sidebar than I intended, but
time on your 30 seconds.
Yeah. Sorry. <All right.
laughs> Lightning round. There it is. Well, that's depressing. But we've got to move on to Yodel Mountain, which we'll see how depressing Yodel Mountain is. Maybe just the normal amount. Here we go. Everybody start yodeling.
It's going to be cold. It's going to be gray. And it's going to last you for the rest of your life.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
Okay, Andrew, Manafort lied. Still only once a year, isn't it? But you're telling me this is a more official version of this. What happened?
Yeah, so we discussed Paul Manafort's plea deal back in episode 211, and that plea deal included, as part of it, what I am lobbying for all lawyers in the future to start calling Manafort clauses in the plea arrangement. Those are specific provisions that say, hey, if you violate any provision of this agreement, not only do we as the government get to tear this agreement up if we want to, but you can't withdraw your plea. We give up. We are no longer bound to do any of the stuff we promised to do. And crucially, right, that there are two things that the government is allowed to do in the event that Paul Manafort breaches his plea agreement. The first is with respect to to Manafort's sentencing, to which they agreed, it releases the government from its obligation to say, okay, you have accepted responsibility. You've acknowledged your guilt. And as we've talked about, under the federal sentencing guidelines, you get a reduction in your sentence, the levels you move down the chart if you've accepted responsibility. Number one, it frees up the government to not have to abide by that deal, because obviously if you're lying to them, if you've breached the agreement, then you haven't accepted your responsibility. And then number two, and this is by far the most important one, because it is going to answer the question that everyone has had. This is paragraph 13, subsection B, in the event of a breach, quote, the government and any other party will be free to use against your client, that is Paul Manafort, directly and indirectly in any criminal or civil proceeding, all statements made by your client, including the statement of the offense, that is, the facts to which he pled guilty, and any of the information or materials provided by your client, including such statements, information, and materials provided pursuant to this agreement, or during the course of any debriefings conducted in anticipation of or after entry of this agreement, whether or not the debriefings were previously part of a proffer protected debriefings, and your client's statements made during the proceedings before the court pursuant to Rule 11 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. Now, what does all that gobbledygook mean? That means everything Paul Manafort has said to Mueller's team in connection with his arrest, in connection with his plea deal, in connection with pleading with them to enter a plea deal, all of it is now released, and Mueller's team can provide that to other federal entities, right? They can provide it to the Department of Justice, in particular, the attorneys, the U.S. attorneys at the Southern District of New York, who have brought the charges against Michael Cohen and some other related proceedings that we'll talk about. They're free to give that to the New York State Attorney General. They're free to share that with my buddy Brian Frosch, and in connection with the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia's emoluments lawsuit against Donald Trump. In short, this is now a situation where everything that Paul Manafort has ever said to behind closed doors to investigators is now fair game to be used in any subsequent proceeding against Paul Manafort. That's a big thing. And it answers kind of the number one question that I got in connection with this determination. I suppose I should take a step back and say that exactly how this came about. So Paul Manafort was about to be sentenced, and the government filed a motion and said, we think that Paul Manafort has violated his plea deal, and that he's done so in five ways. And if you find that he has violated any of that, then we're released from that plea deal and we can do the stuff that I just said that they can do. This is Judge Jackson saying that as a factual matter, on the basis of a sealed hearing, a closed hearing. So we don't know exactly what evidence was put before. We can make some informed guesses. Judge Jackson found that on three of the five arguments that the Office of Special Counsel has met by a preponderance of the evidence, right? That is more likely than not, that Manafort, number one, made false statements to the FBI, the Office of Special Counsel, and the grand jury concerning the payment by Firm A to the law firm. That is in connection with, you might recall, the Skadden Arps. The law firm is Skadden Arps, and you might recall the Skadden Arps lawyer who pled to making false statements in connection with reports to by and between Skadden Arps and the Ukrainian government. Okay, so point number one, they lied about the role that law firm played. Point number two, that the Office of Special Counsel has established by preponderance of the evidence that Manafort made multiple false statements to the FBI, the Office of Special Counsel, and the grand jury concerning matters that were material to the investigation, particularly his interactions and communications with Konstantin Kalimnik, Russian intelligence asset, and that the Office of Special Counsel, this is the third one, has established by preponderance of the evidence that on October 5th, 2018, the defendant intentionally made false statements that were material to another DOJ investigation. Another DOJ investigation here probably means the case against Michael Cohen. We don't know. But that is, when it says another investigation, the most prominent, that means not the Office of Special Counsel. So unconnected to related to but not brought by Mueller's office is the charges that were brought against Michael Cohen. So there is now a determination by Judge Jackson that Paul Manafort lied, and that therefore the government is not bound by the terms of the plea deal. The significance of that, as I've said, are twofold, and they impact the two most commonly asked questions that I get, right? The first is, doesn't this mean, right? Isn't Donald Trump just going to pardon Paul Manafort anyway, right? And the answer to that is he might, but as we've talked about, Paul Manafort is on the hook and has pled guilty to the underlying facts that could easily be used to establish state court tax violations. We talked about that in episode 211, so you can go back and listen to that one. And now those proceedings can use everything he's ever said. I feel really strongly that a reasonably talented chimp could get a conviction of Paul Manafort in state court. I mean, you know, a talented one, right?
Your
run of the mill.
Not your everyday.
Right? Yeah, the ones that can, you know, you have good table manners.
That'd be fun to watch. Chimp Court.
See? I'm telling you.
Better show than a lot of movies.
Right. Yeah, our show ideas are so much
better.
There is
no law that says a chimp can't be a lawyer. There we go. We solved it.
Correct.
We cracked it.
And then number two, you know, people have asked, well, what about the whole, you know, sentencing thing? And I thought this was worth, I won't put a time limit on this, but worth a tiny foray. Manafort's original sentence was offense level 37. 37
wow.
is.
I've only ever gotten to offense level 30. I've never cracked those last seven levels.
Yeah, 37 is a water level.
The boss
so
on
really,
say the boss on offense level 35. I don't know how Manafort got past that one. That's impressive.
The chart only goes to 43, right? Ooh. 43 and.
I mean, then there's the bonus cloud
level
44, but yeah, we won't talk about that. It's fine.
That's life imprisonment, right? And so immediately. Manafort will go from a 37 to a 40, right? Because the 37 was the result of the three-level downward departure due to acceptance of responsibility. That's gone. It will probably it will not be difficult for Judge Jackson to bump Manafort up to a 43 because his lies will aggravate certain other factors. And again, you've only got a get another three levels, and most of these are either plus two or plus four. So Manafort is going to go from 210 months in prison to life in prison. And you might be thinking, well, you know, he's like 106 years old and chain smokes and, you know, seems to be, wears lovely ostrich jackets. Was he really going to survive, you know, 210 months in prison anyway? You know, probably not. I mean, this is a good time. I got asked this question multiple times in email. This is a good time for a sidebar to the sidebar to point out that there is no parole in the federal system. Lots of people think there is, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Federal parole was abolished in 1984, right? So for a great majority of our listener, or at least a strong plurality of our listeners, there has not been federal parole for as long as you've been alive.
I've never thought about that. How's that never come up before? That's interesting.
Yeah, I know. What there is there is credit for good time served. Those are limited to 54 days for each year served, and the statute is 18 U.S.C. 3624B, which says the prisoners are eligible if they exhibit, quote, exemplary compliance with institutional disciplinary regulations, end of quote. So for every year, you can get 54 days off of your sentence. The implication of that is most prisoners will serve 87% on average of their federal sentence. So not a parole, but is a, you know, slight reduction, but nowhere near sort of the reputation that, you know, that I think parole has in the federal system. That, you know, people think, oh, well, you get 20 years, but you're only going to serve nine of those. And then that's not the case. The sentence means almost 90% of
and was this just part of the like Reagan era criminals have it too damn easy kind of thing?
Yep. Okay. Yep. That's exactly what it was. And it also flags the answer to one more question that sometimes comes up. Good time credits only apply to sentences longer than 1 year, but less than life imprisonment. Mm. So if Manafort is bumped up to life imprisonment to level 43, he will not be eligible for any reduction in his sentencing. This also answers why sometimes you will see first-time offenders be sentenced to 1 year and 1 day in prison. And the answer to that is because you get the 54 days of good time credit.
Oh, so it's actually better. So 1 year and 1 day is better for you than 1 year.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep. So giving somebody a year and a day means you're probably giving them 5 to 7 weeks less of a sentence than you would be if you sentenced them to one full year. So I thought we might end with if not a happy thing, at least, you know, a little bit of a diversion off of Yodel Mountain into how do you understand when you see sentences get handed down. So so there you go. That's Paul Manafort. That is the consequence of Judge Jackson determining as a matter of law that he violated his plea deal with Mueller's Office of Special Counsel. It is really, really bad news for Paul Manafort, no matter how you slice it, and couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
All right. Well, with that said, it is time for our co-favorite segment of the week. Yes, our top patrons are Hall of Famers, and that is, of course, people pledging at the $5 level or above on patreon.com/law. And, of course, you got to do that for a month to get your weekly shout-out. And we start with Bijou and Bangles, custom and handcrafted jewelry. Stephen Stephen Balticatai Sandoval, choice early follow unlock spider decrease. Okay, sure. Cut maps. We are going to build a Death Star and make Alderaan pay for it. Yodel, odel, 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 he who released my work schedules. Trapped in Washington Snowmageddon with children, send help. I got patron shout outs, probably not the most efficient way to get help, but yeah, you know, that works.
No, keep doing that. We will send a team of sled dogs right away.
Ron is a MAGA fan, is an anagram of, is an anagram of. That's pretty good. That's very meta. I think we've officially killed that one. All right. Stormy McKendrick, this space intentionally blank. It's not a federal prison. It's an executive timeout. Finally, not single on Valentine's Day. The epic inner battle over Pelosi's State of the Union facial expression. John Bilderbeck. AFSPDaniel.com. Help the overnight walk to stop suicide. Hashtag stop suicide. Republicans, not safe to vote for ever again. Monica, CivilPoliticsRadio.com. Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Don't kid yourself would be a great slogan for an abortion clinic. Okay. The Registry Matters podcast. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Burbank Makerspace. Unintelligible real property question. If it taint one team, it's t'other. DataHeck.com, business automation, making the menial automatic. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. A banana socialist democracy. Blank Boxman. Grand Theft Audio Animatronic. Kurt Robinson. Poop. Just poop. I'm literally giving a shout out to poop. Okay. Hey, it's your patron dollar. Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Chris Rowden, let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. Cosmo Springsteen's wrecking ball is the only wrecking ball. Oh, okay, sure. Schrodinger's Andrew is right and wrong at the same time. That's true. Michael Cohen is a no-talent ass clown. Sam Buck, the Getting Off Podcast. Milo Mead song, The Halfling Bard, and SIU3L. Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, tang.
Walla, walla, bing, bang.
Karma Fleet is recruiting. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Mike the Intactivist. Demeter is 9/10 of environmental law.
Oh, nice. Okay. Nice.
Polychalk, is there any such thing as common law impeachment? Rob Schreck, James, roses are red, violets are blue. Baby Wendy says happy Valentine's Day to you. Oh, that was the cutest one yet. Daylin Lee, same as Grix. Your turn, Andrew.
Thank you to an anagram of unpronounceable characters. To Clownhorn, I missed the name change deadline again. To Anonymous, Brian Upshaw's last chance for profit prison. To Buttercup's legal services, knocking slap suits off the table since 2018, 831 Cat Law 1. Now, I heard that there was a problem with 831 Cat Law 1 last week, so hopefully they have fixed
that. Stop everything, get that fixed.
Yep. At Woman for Conrad Michaels. I hope Conrad Michaels appreciates what we're doing for him here. Blank Box Woman, Nullum Sensum Facet Hoc Nomen Patreon. To Jerome Corsi, hired Larry Klayman to sue Roger Stone. That is 100% correct. It is 100% on the whiteboard, and that lawsuit is 100% fabulous.
Ouroboros is stupid.
Yep. ClampQuest.org, relaxation for robot mafia enforcers. WordOrigins.org, your site for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. The Liberal Gun Club, a pro-Second Amendment voice for left-of-center gun owners.
Right.
I don't know if that's sincere or not, but worth checking out. Zabby, Wiggles McGee, let's all play T5DCTTBE, or the Fifth District Court takes the bar exam. So yep. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah.
Andrew's once and future fantasy baseball daddy. Oh, not this year, my friend, not this year. This millennial was born when we wanted walls torn down. Yeah. Oh, we should definitely play the Scorpions. Anyway. Saul, my name was topical, but I capped my OA pledge at 20. Hashtag fail. Yeah, well, glad we uncapped that and hope that this has been all you've ever dreamed of. Enrage Moping Nuts is an anagram of opening arguments. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters. Illegally Parked Time Machine, pursued for civil forfeiture. Brandon Smith, Impeach the Clown Horn is an anagram for Thomas Smith. Okay, not really. Thomas Smith is my favorite Thomas Smith. Thomas Smith is a close second. Oh. The Thomas Smith Brigade is out in force. I'm glad to see that. An anagram of Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a Canada shrub seeks her. Rhonda is wearing her amicus briefs. Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch. CampQuest.org, 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 the original. Soggy Pants, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, too busy with new puppy to be clever. Well, I get that. Relationship status, buying half off Valentine's Day candy today. Now, do you think that means they don't have a Valentine and they're just stocking up on candy, or that they have a Valentine that they just don't care that much about?
Well, I think they very smartly realize that it's this actually technically goes out the day after Valentine's Day.
So they're gonna
get all that day after Valentine's Day half off candy.
Got it. Yeah.
They're smarter than us.
Yeah, good for you. Load up on candy. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon, Aaron Grady, hundreds of hamburgers in an alley. Sakashite Fukasumi gets between 0 and 2 shout outs per week. Saint Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Eli Bosnick, Mitchell. If Picard isn't the best captain, then why is he the one coming back?
Ooh, oh, nice.
I'm with you on that one. Nancy Pelosi's sarcasm clap was the best part of the State of the Union. Agreed. Conrad Michaels Jr. wannabe and our top patron with, I believe, 5 separate shout outs from our patrons this week. Conrad Michaels. See,
it's when good you're to be at the king. The
top, yeah. When you're at the peak of the mountain, I was going to go on, but it's good to be the king is a much better. It's a good Mel Brooks History of the World part one shout out. It's good to be the king. So congratulations to the king. If you want to try and dethrone him, you know you want to try, head on over to patreon.com/law and you give us $5 an episode. We will read you every single week, even if it's a Conrad Michaels related name, even if it's embarrassing. We can and are bought.
All right. Let's hop on over to TTTBE with special guest.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right. And joining us for TTTBE this week is special guest AG from Mueller. She wrote, so excited to have you. How are you doing?
I am so good. Thank you guys for having me. And thanks for coming on Mueller. She wrote.
You're welcome. You're talking to Andrew. Yeah, no. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for doing
you guys as a show, you know, you were repped.
I'm just teasing. Correct choices were made in that. All right. Let's deal with our question this week. And I have to emphasize, AG, don't help me. You know, you got to let me take first crack at it. Sanctity of the game. Make sure, you know, I take first crack and then you can tell me how I did. Because I'm sure you. Are we getting a. Don't tell me we're getting real property. Are you going to embarrass me in front of our guest?
Not only are you getting real property, but this question is like 87 pages long. I apologize. Geez. It's what came up in the book. We've had some great coincidences, like, you know, Andrew Seidel being on and us getting a question on a case that he worked on. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. I wasn't going to win that one.
Yeah, we had the abortion question on the episode where we were covering June Medical Services, and we have AG on, so she gets to sit here and listen to me read a.
Yeah, feel free to take a short nap during this question.
All right, so the two of you, here you go. Here's your question: a businessman owned a hotel, subject to a mortgage securing a debt he owed to a bank. The businessman later acquired a nearby parking garage, financing a part of the purchase price with a loan from the financing company secured by a mortgage on the parking garage. 2 years thereafter, the businessman defaulted on the loan owed to the bank, which caused the full amount of that loan to become immediately due and payable. The bank decided not to foreclose the mortgage on the hotel at that time, but instead properly sued for the full amount of the defaulted loan. The bank obtained and properly filed a judgment for that amount. A statute of the jurisdiction provides, quote, any judgment properly filed shall, for 10 years from filing, be a lien on the real property then owned or subsequently acquired by any person against whom the judgment is rendered, end of quote. There is no other applicable statute, except for the statute providing for judicial foreclosure of mortgages, which places no restrictions on deficiency judgments. You still with me? We're about two-thirds of the way through.
Not even close.
Shortly thereafter, the bank brought an appropriate action for judicial foreclosure of its mortgage on the hotel and of its judgment lien on the parking garage. The financing company was joined as a party defendant and appropriately sued for foreclosure of its mortgage on the parking garage, which was also in default. All procedures were properly followed, and the confirmed foreclosure sales resulted in the following. The net proceeds of the sale of the hotel to a third party were $200,000 less than the bank's mortgage balance. The net proceeds of the sale of the parking garage to a fourth party were $200,000 more than the financing company's mortgage balance. Okay? Super complicated fact pattern, and these happen every once in a while. Now, how should the $200,000 surplus from the sale of the parking garage be distributed? A. It should be paid to the bank. B, it should be paid to the businessman. C, it should be paid to the financing company. Or D, it should be split equally between the bank and the financing company.
Does anybody have a four-sided coin? I don't care. The answer is I don't care. This is so. If you're not familiar with the bar, real property is the part where you just quit because there's no point to even trying. I've discovered. So my test-taking strategy here would be not to waste my precious time with the fact pattern. I honestly can't even follow this one. This is how real property questions are. It's unfortunate that we couldn't have one that was a real question today, but that's okay. Let's see.
I'm sorry. I do. While Thomas is reading, I will tell you, like, part of the sanctity of the game here is I also don't read I literally just edit the questions in Paint from the book, and I don't read them, and I don't read the answers. I mean, I don't read the explanations for the answers so that I'm not like giving anything away while I read the question. Because one of our listeners told me that like they think I have a tell when like Thomas gets the answers right or wrong. And they got a couple that way. So I do my best to be as cold as I can coming into it. Had I put my finger on the scale, I definitely would have gotten a less horrendous question here.
All right, let me see if the last few sentences offer anything. Financing company joined as a Probably sued for foreclosure on the mortgage. All procedures were properly followed, and the confirmed foreclosure sales result in the following. Third party, less than the bank's mortgage balance. The net proceeds of the sale of the parking garage to fourth party more. I have no idea. I don't. This is stupid. Let me go with. I literally can't even. This is one. It sucks that we have a guest because I would normally read this for like a minute of silence, but I'm not going to do that. So let's do. How about it's paid to the. I feel like the banks always win, so I'll guess A. So AG, we're taking TTB off this week. We'll come back to it next week with a real question. I mean, this is seriously. If you were taking this test, Andrew, would you even bother with it? Like, look at this. It's not worth it. Just give up. It's like the SAT when you don't know it. Like, just not. Don't waste your time.
I have an answer.
Do it.
All right.
When did we find out if we're right? By the way,
when on Tuesday's show?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, normally I think that this would go, usually I would say it would go to the businessman, because if the bank wanted to take a short sale on the other property, that's their effing problem. However, in this case, if a judgment was properly filed, there's a 10-year lien on any real property owned or subsequently acquired by any person against whom the judgment is rendered. So this guy defaulted after 2 years, that falls within the 10 years. So the bank filed a judgment, it filed it properly. The judgment comes with a lien. The bank has the lien, so the bank gets the money.
All right. So you are also going with A then.
So you're agreeing with my expert analysis. Okay.
I sure am. Because the bank always wins.
Oh, wow. Well, that was an intelligent answer. I'm glad we had you here to actually give listeners some value in this TTTB segment for this week. All right, so
I think the question's poorly worded, though, because it says that the businessman defaulted on the loan he owed to the bank, but it doesn't say which loan. He's got two at this point. He's got a partially financed parking garage and a fully financed hotel, and it also doesn't really say that the financing company and the bank are the same or two separate entities, where you have to assume they are because there's two separate answers for them in the answer.
This happens often.
I've never seen a financing company come in separate from a bank, but whatevs.
No, I mean, it happens often that the question, I where you're like, oh, I wish it would tell me this, but I guess you have to assume something, and yeah. But all right, well, let me say,
these are official bar exam prep questions from the NCBE, the National Conference of Bar Examiners. So, like, this is what we actually get stuck with as lawyers, as would-be lawyers, when we're trying to study for this exam. So what you're going through is a tiny fraction of what I went through when I had to take this exam.
Because in the real world, you'd be able to get those answers, you know?
Yeah. But then the problem is the answer to every bar exam question would be, I don't know, let me ask the client about that. And it might make it easy to game the system. Okay. All right. Answers are locked in. If you want to play along with TTTB, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include your answer. Include the hashtag TTTB, your reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner over the weekend and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And, of course, tune in Tuesday for a special interview with AG of Mueller. She wrote, thanks so much for coming on. Thanks, Andrew, for embarrassing me in front of our esteemed guest. And we'll see everybody on Tuesday. All right. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening. Thanks most of all to our patrons, of course, and Andrew for keeping us enraged. We're enraged moping nuts. No, we're not the enraged moping nuts. about the Supreme Court. Stay mad, everybody, and keep voting with that anger. And we will see you along with our special guest returning on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. Thank you. podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.